Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in East European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Link, and today we'll be speaking with Erica Lehrer about her book, Jewish Poem. Welcome to New Books in East European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Link, and today we'll be speaking with Erica Lehrer about her book, Jewish Poem Revisited, Heritage Tourism in Unquiet Places. And I want to say that I've known about this project since it was in its infancy. Erica contacted me when I was in grad school, and it's really great to see this book come to fruition. So, hello, Erica. How are you?
Hi, Hugo. This is fun. Yeah, I remember I was an undergraduate at Grinnell College in Iowa, and I guess you were at University of Michigan, where I later ended up. So it's fun to be invited, and thanks for having me.
Well, it is really a pleasure of mine. And why don't we start by talking about how this project came to be in the first place, and your discovery or your Eastern Europe project?
I went to Poland for reasons that really had no immediate relation to anything Jewish at all. Basically, I was taking a year off from college in 1989-90. And so, of course, you know, this was the beginning of all of these major political transformations in Eastern Europe. And I was, you know, kicking around, I'm not sure what to do, a bit at loose ends. And my brother and I, encouraged by our parents, decided that we should go and see the revolution. And, you know, of course, I think in the back of our minds, there was some vague sense that this was a place that we drew our own family heritage as well. I think my father made me a map that he laminated, where he put sort of little pen points on the sites which were in Poland, although today are in the Ukraine, where our family was from. So there was that as a backdrop as well. And I think, you know, that the combination of this being kind of a revolutionary, transformative moment, sort of both politically, but also, of course, socially and culturally, and then my own subjectivity, you know, led to various encounters that I had with people in Poland that opened up the themes that I then became quite fascinated by and pursued in the book. And I can maybe tell one anecdote. So I think, you know, the way people responded to us as Jews was with a level of fascination that, of course, nobody at home ever responded to me I think, you know, the fact that the Jewish narrative, Jewish history, Jewish culture was not a topic of free conversation. It was a taboo topic during the communist period. So there were a generation of people who had heard, you know, around kitchen tables, their parents or grandparents speak about, you know, Jewish neighbors, Jewish shopkeepers, Jewish friends, but of course had never met a Jew themselves. And I remember meeting one young 20-year-old guy who said, you know, for him, Jews were something like out of a fairy tale book, like, you know, it would be like Maria, John, and Jew, just some kind of character that, you know, not from their own social life. And so then these two, you know, young backpacking American Jews show up, start bumping into people in Poland. And of course, that, you know, we seemed like we dropped out of a fairy tale or out of a history book. And so, you know, lots of questions, which led to questions of my own. And I remember having been invited to stay over at the homes of a lovely Polish couple that we met on a train. We stayed over at their home in Olsztyn in northern Poland for a couple of nights. And when we came to their home, I remember seeing that they had a menorah on their dining table. And I was really surprised. And I just blurted out, "Oh, I didn't know that you were Jewish." And the gentleman looked at me kindly and said, "Oh, well, we're not Jewish." And of course, in my, you know, suburban North American Jewish mind, I thought, like, wait, why would a non-Jew have a menorah? That doesn't make sense. And so I asked, and he just explained to me that it was an artifact. And I think hearing that word in that place by that person, you know, of course, you know, going to Poland and having coming from a family that had a very, you know, kind of powerful, definitive Holocaust experience. My mother had been a wartime refugee, lost all of her family who had been in Poland at the time. There were just so many resonances and so many emotions around that sense of that someone could have a piece of what I considered, quote, my culture, and see it in a sense as a museum piece, opened, you know, in some ways I could say all of the questions that then, you know, became the topic of the book.
You know, it's fascinating. I remember a friend, I have a friend who is of a dark complexion and has an aquiline nose, which of course fits into Mickiewicz's description of the Polish Lachta as well. And she described to me, she's Polish, she described and grew up in Poland, having somebody, this is in, again, about 86, 87. And of course, things are already changing a little bit, and asking her, stopping her on the street and saying, you know, excuse me, this is not about that, but are you Jewish? You look so perfectly Jewish. There was that kind of interest. A lot of your book focuses on Kazimierz, which for those who are unaware, is kind of a Jewish satellite city that dates from the medieval time of Krakow. And would you talk about that and its centrality in Jewish culture in Poland today?
Okay, well, so, I mean, well, maybe, if you don't mind, maybe could I say a few things about sort of Jewish culture? I know you're interested in sort of the development of the tourist industry, et cetera, more generally, and then I can return to Kazimierz within that?
Sure, sure, if you'd like to do that, that's fine.
Okay.
Whatever you think works for you.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say a few words about, you know, this issue of Jewish culture as an engine or having a role in relation to the tourist industry in Poland more generally, post-communism. And, you know, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the role of Jewish culture in relation to tourism more generally. So, you know, looking at Jewish culture as something that was one of the kind of exportable pieces of sort of, you know, cultural interest since the late 1980s, something that was that you could see visible in English language tourist maps produced by what was then the Ministry of Tourism. So a sense that there was something interesting or marketable about Jewishness. But I'm not really sure that Jewish culture was a huge draw for international tourists, aside, however, from Jewish tourists. But in some ways, I think Jews either came or didn't come to Poland for their own very powerful reasons. Auschwitz and Holocaust tourism, though, I think was a bigger draw, which sometimes, of course, gets totally conflated with Jewish history, sometimes gets separated from it. But I think Auschwitz is probably the biggest international tourist destination in Poland. But Jewish culture, I think, played a larger role in the development of internal national Jewish tourism. So by the early 2000s, you have like the development of a kind of middle class with some disposable income in Poland, and Jewish festivals like one that actually was something that I had encountered on that first trip to Poland, Krakow's Jewish Festival. Which became a very major one, and this year is in, I think it's 27th year, along with some more provincial ones that grew up later in the 2000s, like in cities like Chmielnik or other places across the country. Jewish culture in this form sort of became a magnet for Polish culture seekers, which at first I think had to do with people really being drawn to alternative culture just in general. So, you know, as an alternative to this homogenous Catholic Polishness that was all that was on offer under communism. But then later, you know, with the development of this leisure class, just a magnet for people looking for an interesting destination. And so the festival, more recently, the Pauline Museum of the History of Polish Jews, which opened very recently in 2014, have probably helped shift the attitudes of some foreign Jews to Poland. But most Jewish tourism to Poland, I think I would still categorize as having the quality of a kind of pilgrimage. So something you feel like you have to do once kind of dutifully. And I talk a lot about different qualities of different kinds of Jewish tourism in the book. I think Kazimierz, coming back to your question, Kazimierz fit into that in some interesting ways. It's, as you said, Kazimierz is this really unique East European medieval Jewish quarter that was not destroyed during World War II. And so it sort of forms this incredible like mise en scène for re-engagement with the memory of the Jewish past. And it's something that its own enlivenment as a quarter, re-enlivenment, because of course it had been, even though the infrastructure, the built environment was not destroyed, the Jewish human environment was during the war. So the kind of re-enlivenment of the space began with local non-Jewish activists, along with some.
I think we should clarify one thing. The reason it was allowed to stand was because the Nazis had planned to turn it into a museum of everything that was wrong with Judaism. And the Jews. So I just wanted to clarify why that had happened and what made it so unique. Continue.
Oh, well, you know what? I'd like to open that because, in fact, that's not something I've heard in particular. My understanding is that Kazimierz was not destroyed simply because, you know, Krakow was the center of the general government. And, you know, Hans Frank, the Nazi general, was ruling from Wawel Castle there. And simply that he... That he appreciated the city so much and simply, you know, he was inhabiting there. He had his home out in Przegorzawy and this castle on the outskirts of Krakow and simply didn't want the city destroyed. But it's interesting. Maybe you know something about it that I don't. But yes, back to Kazimierz in the late, you know, late 1980s, early 1990s, yes, it was so an undestroyed medieval Jewish quarter, and it had, I believe, 7 synagogues, multiple houses of prayer, a couple of intact mikvahs. But this was it had really become essentially a kind of ghetto in the North American sense. It had become a rundown quarter where you could. Buy rotgut alcohol and there were stray dogs. It was not a place that anyone who didn't have to, live there would want to go at night. But it began to be also a place for kind of this first generation of seekers of, what have we not been told? What have we lost? What have we, what has fallen out of our consciousness in this generation of communism? So local Jews with their own sort of awakening curiosity and emboldenment during the waning years of communist rule, checking out the neighborhood. Of course, it was a place that, their parents or grandparents maybe had gone to synagogue. And the synagogue there in the quarter actually had functioned kind of hobblingly, continuously throughout throughout continuously since the wartime, but they could rarely get a minyan or the necessary quorum of Jewish men necessary to do formal prayer. But it was a place that you could find a few old Jews on Saturday on the Sabbath. But then it was also discovered by local non-Jewish activists who simply felt that this was a site that should be remembered for its historical significance, and started opening different kinds of I guess you could call them heritage institutions that in some way marked the Jewish past, the Jewish history of the quarter, a Jewish bookshop, a Jewish cafe, then later various kinds of cabarets, then pretty soon the Jewish Culture Festival, which had started in 1988 in a movie theater on the other side of town, moved by 1990 into Kazimierz. So this site, became a kind of magnet because of its own history, the awakening interests of both local Jews and particularly local non-Jews. And then also the space, I argue, has its own kind of particular like genius loci of the literal built fabric of the urban fabric. It's this enclosed square plus a few blocks of buildings around it that if you visit it, you kind of get caught in this little cul-de-sac, I would say, and people of very varying backgrounds and interests meet each other there. And I argue that a lot of realizations, changing attitudes, both on the side of local non-Jewish people who were engaging with Jewish culture, and also visiting Jews from abroad, as well as local Jews. There was like this kind of, alchemy happening here, where people were forced to engage with each other in a situation for many people of very high emotion. Also different kinds of naivete on all sides. And they pushed each other and changed each other's minds, created a lot of realizations which were important socially and politically, I think.
Why don't we go from there and talk about two sort of separate but converging issues, and that is the state of Poland's small Jewish community at the end of communism first, and then talk about Jewish attitudes towards Poland and the development of heritage tourism, what you call heritage tourism, and specifically towards Poland. Why don't we do that next?
When I think about heritage tourism, I think about travel that engages with what the travelers deem to be significant elements of a community's historical experience. So heritage is kind of the... It's like heritage is the past that we value or the past that haunts us. Now, Jack Hugemas, who's another really interesting anthropologist, traces a kind of what I believe he calls homeland travel back to the early 20th century, when Jewish emigrants who were, kind of made good generally in North America came back to visit and sometimes, interestingly, film their old country relatives. But of course, this ability, the desire, and also the perspective on this kind of return changed really radically with the Holocaust and its various aftermaths. And so throughout the communist period, you had really just a trickle of this kind of ancestral pilgrimage. Interestingly, this, of course, includes like Hasidic pilgrimage to graves of important rabbis, tzaddikim, which is kind of a parallel thread, which in some small ways intersects with larger kinds of Jewish tourism, and in other ways was very hermetic. But also, individual one-on-one meetings with local Jews. In thinking about, the Jewish community in Poland by the end of communist rule was, it looked moribund. Basically, you had, despite there being this one synagogue, the Ramus Synagogue in Krakow that had been technically open with a few people hanging around, on Shabbat and on high holidays. If you wanted to find Jews, the other place you would find them was in the what was called the TS Kajet, or the Jewish Social and Cultural Organization, which was the one sort of formally permitted Jewish organization during communism. And that's essentially where where, you know, it was a few older men, mostly who had married non-Jewish wives. And that's the place where they would get together to be Jewish. And that meant for them, I think, speaking a little bit of Yiddish, you know, and drinking coffee. You know, Jews, you know, so there had been 3.5 million Jews in Poland before World War II. And this was this incredibly rich, diverse community. I think it was the biggest Jewish community outside of New York, outside of the US. And you know, it had, you know, all manner of you know, stripes of religion, political engagement, social class, et cetera. And of course, you know, most of them, sort of 3.2 million of them were murdered during the Holocaust, and 300,000 of them, most of whom had survived in the Soviet Union, came back to Poland, but many of them quickly left because the conditions were very unwelcoming. And then the, you know, the some tens of thousands of Jews who were still there by the end of the 1940s, early 1950s, you know, trickled out during various moments of increasing anti-Semitism, most particularly what we have an anniversary of this year, the 1968 government-sponsored anti-Semitic campaign, during which about 13,000 of what were then the remaining, I think, 23,000 Jews were given these one-way passports and encouraged to emigrate, which most of them did. So, you know, by the time someone like me arrived in Poland in early 1990, you saw, you know, a few Jewish men hanging around the synagogue or hanging around this Jewish social club who, yeah, clearly had also become used to sort of performing their Jewishness for people like me, you know, showing how they were still there, you know, speaking a little bit of Yiddish, talking about their memories of the war, or their parents' memories of what had happened to their family, and often, you know, asking for a little bit of money to help them, ostensibly with the synagogue, but I think they needed it, you know, personally as much. And I think, you know, these people also became a kind of particular, a very aestheticized image and idea about Jewishness in Poland at that time. There was this discourse, which was supported by news reporting and some documentary photographers, that, you know, Jewishness in Poland was a case of just some remnants, some traces. There was this National Geographic article and then a book called Remnants, The Last Jews of Poland, which really, you know, showed these people in incredibly impoverished situations and really, you know, kind of voicing this discourse of we are all that's left. This is the end of the line. And so, you know, of course, for them, these visits from outsiders, from foreign Jews and from, you know, locals interested in Jewishness were incredibly important, both in terms of their own kind of self-understanding or conception of what would be possible as a, you know, as a community, in terms of, like, I think that for them, the sudden interest in Jewishness, I think, seemed, you know, perhaps too little too late, a bit superficial, but of course, materially, it was useful for them. But of course, the emergence of heritage tourism, the enlivening of Kazimierz, brought all sorts of other Jews or other people who identified with Jewishness out of the woodwork, both locally and more further afield, who would come to Kazimierz, because it became, in all of Poland, I think, one of the first public spots that was marked as Jewish, that people felt comfortable coming to and in some way being Jewish openly. You know, in terms of the tourism, maybe this is a moment just to mention, aside from this kind of trickle of individual tourists, and then of course the Hasidic pilgrims who were crossing through Kazimierz, but sort of doing their own thing, there were these groups that that are often called, and I call them in my book, missions. So these are overwhelmingly youth oriented, but not always, but Jewish communally organized travel groups, really with a sense of mission that they are going somewhere to to a kind of outpost of you know, remnant Jewishness in the world, and coming both with their own interest, but also their desire, perhaps to help in some way or to give some kind of support. And this includes, you know, major Israeli state-sponsored youth missions that that all high school students are encouraged to go on. And so you would have these in the spring. You would have these massive influxes of young, vibrant Jewish people who were suddenly pouring through these spaces, filling the synagogue, you know, singing with great gusto, and you know, the engagements of some of these people was easier to do for people who are traveling on their own, but the presence of these large groups also were really sort of part of the kind of important encounters that I argue happen in Kazimierz, giving people in Poland a sense of Jewishness as a living force rather than simply, you know, something from the past that is, you know, in the state of remnants, that the Jews can be, you know, like, young and fun and sexy and, you know, just simply alive in the present day rather than related to, you know, people with black coats and sidelocks or, you know, not to put it too crassly, but simply a pile of dead bodies, was really pretty shocking for many people.
Could you talk more about the particular mission that, and what they are, how they focus? Because I think it does shape how, you know, some of the aspects of dialogue and where the dialogue takes place that you describe in the book.
Absolutely.
Or doesn't take place in some cases.
Absolutely. So I make this distinction between two forms of travel that I call a mission and a quest. And a mission, as I was describing, are these really large, insular, highly kind of self-motivated travel groups that are really on a mission. And they, in many ways, use Poland as, Poland is a kind of a stage on which to perform a kind of a pageant of death and redemption. I believe those were Jack Kugelmass's words. Use Poland in a way to kind of play out a set of Jewish communal concerns about waning identification among young people in North America or lack of knowledge in Israel about the Holocaust, and the sense that bringing people to you know, the site of the Holocaust, to have people have an embodied, I would dare say, almost traumatic experience of the Holocaust would be a kind of it would kind of vaccinate them in a way against losing their Jewishness. It would in some sense, you know, scare them into being Jewish or give them this real sense of the import of remaining Jewish, because look, this is the backdrop. This is what will happen otherwise. So there was, in terms of mission travel, there was this incredible disinterest in Poland as something that actually existed in the present day. So just as if Poles had, just as if on the Polish side, there was little knowledge or understanding about contemporary Jewish life, these Jewish mission tours were completely not interested in Poland as a present day country. These trips to Poland were a sense, an opportunity to visit the Holocaust, to travel back in time, and to have a Holocaust experience, which meant that people in those trips, for the most part, did not meet any Polish people beyond the driver of their bus, and perhaps the guide at various places that would simply bring them, buy the tickets. Usually, these trips went from death camp to death camp, visiting those memorial sites. Rarely with any opportunities to do anything that wasn't Holocaust related. Often there was, you know, encouragement not to spend money. There really was a sense that the real goal here is to have an intense experience of the Holocaust, not to in any way possible to avoid having a fun trip, which included, not being in contact with local people who frankly, were construed as being dangerous, as being, you know, a sea of anti-Semites around, as being simply a continuity from this Holocaust past that was being being sort of curated for these trips. And so, you know, we can talk about the evolution and potentially the change in those trips, as well as the limitations that I believe are inherent in that form of travel. But that's something that for me was very much in distinction to what I called quests, which were people who came in small groups. They were motivated by often individual kinds of kind of catalysts, like wanting to find an ancestral place, wanting to come see this, this, yes, also traumatic Holocaust-related site, but in a way that had to do with their need to perhaps try to work through some experiences that they had personally, being children or grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. And so, you know, these were people who were looking in some ways, I think, to undo the kinds of stories that they grew up with rather than to reinforce them. And, you know, these were people who also, because of the logistics of travel on one's own, were much, much more likely to have extended personal encounters with local people, whether they be Jews or non-Jews. And I think often the contacts with non-Jews were really catalytic ones. But those were often very transformative experiences for people on both sides, to simply engage with each other, you know, talk about what they knew and what they didn't know, what they were curious about. And frankly, even when Jewish people came with a lot of anger and pain about Poland, and had a tour guide or a bookshop, you know, clerk or someone to unleash their distress and their own trauma and their own displeasure on, because it was one-on-one, those things often opened out into conversations or simply marked the people on the Polish side in ways that were really often thought-provoking. And I think kind of created the possibility, you'd sowed the seeds for sort of personal and political transformations that were really significant in terms of people changing what they knew, what they understood, and also how they pursued their own activism vis-a-vis Jewish heritage in Poland.
You know, I think one of the figures in that book that comes back to mind is this fellow who's now based in London, I believe, and he keeps on coming back. And, you know, you mentioned sort of obliquely a bookstore, and that is a site where you speak a lot about as a place for negotiation and a reconciliation and dialogue. And perhaps you could talk about both those things.
Okay, sorry, both of which things?
This man is an example of this kind of being caught up in. It was never quite clear to me what his connection, why he felt this need to come back. He seemed torn in himself, this London-based Jewish fellow. And that on the one hand, and then talk about this bookstore that that you used as a sort of base to a certain extent as you did your field work.
Okay, I'm actually not entirely sure which gentleman you're talking about. So I'll talk about the bookstore first, and then maybe you can tell me more about who you're remembering. One site that really became my kind of base of operations during the multiple years when I was doing field work in Krakow and in Kazimierz is what came to be called the Jarden or Jarden Jewish Bookshop, which is run by a couple, Zdzisław and Lucina Lesz. And they were one of the first, this was one of the first kind of, you know, publicly Jewishly kind of branded institutions in Kazimierz. They opened, I believe, in 1994. And this was around the same time with the first instantiation of what came to be called Cafe Ariel. And there were lots of different versions of that and disputes over the years, but a small cafe that became also a Jewish cafe were opened and became really crucial spaces, both for, you know, to function as kind of potential places of connection, of places where you could encounter people for travelers from abroad, as well as local non-Jews to discover Jewish culture, but equally for local Jews who, as I was mentioning before, didn't really have any public space to be Jewish. Certainly the Teyes Kajet kind of social club filled with older men was not an attractive spot, or not even a spot where young people would feel welcomed to come. And so these kinds of, Jewishly, let's say, themed or Jewishly branded spaces like the bookshop became incredibly important kind of crossroads and meeting spaces for all different kinds of people who were interested in Jewishness. They also, for example, became the de facto kind of academic bookshop for the developing, growing Jewish studies program and their student cohorts at the nearby Jagiellonian University. So the bookshop also ended up becoming a kind of informal consultation space for students. So many Jewish studies theses were born over conversation with Zdzisław and Lucina Lesz in the Yarden Jewish bookshop among students. And actually, interestingly, multiple PhDs and then later Jewish studies scholars, some of whom of quite successful, prominent nature, actually grew up through that bookshop. The bookshop not only sold books, but also gave local tours. They developed, they were there and open when Steven Spielberg came and filmed Schindler's List, the big Hollywood blockbuster, using Kazimierz as the quarter. So they published along with a local journalist, a guide to the sites from Schindler's List. They also developed their own, let's say, casual training program for young people to become guides of Jewish Kazimierz. Many people who were in my book were kind of interlocutors in my fieldwork as, quote, subjects of my study as young tour guides are now colleagues at North American universities in Jewish studies, whether it be Yiddish studies, history, et cetera. So this bookshop for me was really a kind of uncanny site that, microcosm though it was, really showed the kind of possibilities for kind of processes of working through. The term reconciliation is, a problematic one in so many ways, gives a sense of closure, of finishedness, of that everything is somehow okay and we're all on the same page. But rather, I like to think about sort of conciliatory processes, that when there are spaces, when people can come and really talk about, what they know, what they feel, what they understand with other people who have different perspectives, even if those conversations are very difficult, a space where you can have those conversations, and where the people who are running these businesses see those kinds of encounters, those kinds of difficult conversations, and really developing their own understanding as part of their work, as part of their mission. That says so much to me about what was invisible in what became seen and widely reported on in the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera, about this Jewish tourist industry, this Jewishness without Jews, this Jewishness for sale, Holocaust Disneyland. What I saw in that bookshop and in some similar sites was all of this kind of richness, struggling with political commitment and struggling with the ethics and the morality of engaging with Jewishness as non-Jews in this historical moment in really profound ways. So it gave me just kind of a window onto, another sort of, let's say, stream in society that I think is very important. And that's something I could even return to thinking about the present moment, given the direction, the really unfortunate direction that Poland has been taking politically and culturally now, that there still are, and there's this long-standing thread of progressive Polish people who really are working very hard to engage with the very, the nuanced, including the very difficult Jewish past in Poland, and that frankly began tangled up with Jewish heritage tourism.
I was hoping to close out by talking a little bit about the situation. This book as sort of closes in, I believe, 2007. Things have not, the last 10 years have not been a great period in Polish history, I fear. The fellow's name, I just found it here, is Max Rogers, described as a 40-year-old Hasidic Londoner. That's just to remind you. I don't know if there's, I think you've already said a fair amount, you don't need to, but that's who I was speaking. Why don't we move on? I mean, sort of, we're leading into this, so it's a segue, because the couple that run this bookstore, I believe, are not Jewish, and you describe them, use a term, Shabbos Goyim, and perhaps you could first explain the history of that term briefly, and then talk about this phenomenon as you see it in Poland.
Sure. Maybe I'll say one sort of prefatory remark leading into that. So it's very complicated to talk about people as Jewish and non-Jewish in this social setting in which I entered into. And so I also began calling people Jewish identified. Determining who is a Jew, you know, in the best of circumstances can be difficult, but given the history, given the recent history of, you know, from since the war in Poland, people who, basically there was such a trauma and so much death and so much, kind of human chaos, and people ended up in hiding, and people ended up being given away, and people ended up not knowing who their parents were, and also just choices to, after such a trauma, disidentifying with Jewishness. Determining who is and who is not Jewish in this setting is really difficult, and it's also in a social and political setting where Jewishness itself is kind of a taboo subject, and you're not really sort of allowed to ask someone right out if they're Jewish. That's considered really, it would be the same thing as, say, in the 1980s, maybe asking someone in North America if they were gay, in the middle of a party, just something that you didn't do. So I don't actually want to even say that people are or are not Jewish, because many people come to these undertakings, many of these so-called non-Jewish activists, with various kinds of Jewish ancestry themselves, which they either know about and choose not to speak about, sometimes speak about, sometimes don't even know about. So that's just to say that, yes, I would say that the owners of this bookshop are Jewish identified, meaning very close to Jewish issues, very much in support, very knowledgeable, and disidentified with Catholic Polish culture. To this term that I used, Shabbos Goyim, so Shabbos Goyim traditionally were local non-Jews that supported Jews in various ways to take care of work that that Jews could not do because of ritual prohibitions on the Sabbath. Like, there are all of these rules about not being able to turn off or turn on lights, turn on your stove, etc. And so Shabbos Goyim, often when there were things that had to be done that Jews couldn't do, helped take care of those things. Now, this is a really imperfect metaphor for what I wanted to describe as a kind of kinship that I saw developing between non-Jewish caretakers of Jewish heritage in Poland. But I guess I would say that I really liked the sense of like a cross community ethics of caretaking, which it sort of bubbled up as an image Jews are not present in this situation to do something themselves, and so the non-Jews have stepped in to help with a sense of two communities somehow dependent on each other. And then it also has a kind of ritual or kind of ethical aspect. But I also should say that I didn't just, I tried to be a good anthropologist and not take external terms and foist them onto the situation. But I first heard the term Shabbos Goyim being used as a local indigenous category. And I actually heard it used by Janusz Makuch, who was the non-Jewish founder of Krakow's Jewish Cultural Festival, to describe his own role vis-a-vis Jews. So what is it? For him, it was a way to give himself a kind of meaningful social position that legitimized his founding of a Jewish culture festival as a non-Jew, because I think he, on his end, faced a lot of pressure of, why would you do that? So to kind of reach out for, look, there are historical, kind of terms that indicate, prior relations where Jews and non-Jews rely on each other in some productive way.
I thought it was just very interesting to see all that blossoming. And I mean, you're certainly right. I mean, my own understanding of it, I mean, there's so many people who have Jewish roots and don't talk about it, or have only come to talk about it in the post-communist period. I think that the distinction you're making makes a lot of sense. I want to move on to another aspect of tourism, and that's the commercial aspect. As I recall, one of the first things that kind of caught your eye were carvings of shtetl Jews you saw for sale in Krakow. And how has your research altered your understanding of those carvings and the marketing of Jewish culture today in Poland?
Oh, okay, that's a big one. Okay, in the broader sense, before talking about the carvings specifically, I guess I like to remind people that, in terms of the commercial transactions around any kind of, cultural form, always people who are doing something in a really in-depth way, with a lot of commitment, with a sense of ethics or deep engagement, or even really deep interest, that's always going to be the minority of people, right? I think the expectation that most people who are somehow engaged in consuming Jewish culture are doing it in some deep way, that would be more than we would ask in any kind of cultural setting. People engaged in this industry, I was drawn to the people who were really deeply engaged, who were using the potential to the potential inherent in heritage tourism in creating a market for heritage as a kind of political and ethical act. But that's not to say that once you have a Jewish restaurant, even a Jewish bookshop, a Jewish cabaret, or are selling tourist tchotchkes, that those in any way, have a kind of depth. But I also didn't want to exclude the fact that sometimes they do, and show how, even these most seemingly superficial settings, through the kind of encounter that I was talking about, sometimes really spark a lot of deep introspection and the possibility for political and cultural transformation. That's sort of my way of saying, yes, I mean, there are a lot of really kind of crass, superficial engagements with Jewish culture, for sure, just like with any other kind of culture. And I often like to invoke the way that North Americans engage with Native American culture. But there is the possibility for something different. Turning to the figurines, the figurines fascinated me for a very long time and still fascinate me. And in fact, in some ways, they mark a real through line from my very first trip to Poland until my next project, which I can tell you a bit about if you're interested. So in that very first trip in 1990, I also visited Zakopane, so this southern resort town in the mountains. And at a small outdoor flea market, I saw a wooden figurine of a Jew, which actually had a kind of mechanism so that you could put it on the edge of a table and it would bobble back and forth, and it was holding a book, and so it would look like it was engaged in this traditional kind of Hasidic kind of shuckling, rocking version of prayer. It had a big nose and just did not look like a pleasant depiction. It was really, and it struck me on that first trip, with all of my family history, history of the Holocaust in my mind, is this incredible affront, incredible offense, very anti-Semitic. Fast forward, I saw those figurines, here and there throughout the years, but fast forward to when I started doing my research more deeply in the very late 1990s, early 2000s, there was an explosion of these figurines. They were starting to crop up all over the place. And in a sort of unfortunate twist, which I think also kind of changed a certain meaning of them, or added a new layer on, sometime in the early 2000s, many, many of them started holding gold coins. So really kind of pushing that negative Jewish stereotype really kind of to the max. I got really fascinated in the figurines because they were confusing. You know, my gut feeling was they looked at minimum highly stereotypical, if not anti-Semitic. And yet I was finding them, you know, in the homes and in the shops of incredibly committed, progressive, wonderful people who were doing everything that they could to, you know, stamp out anti-Semitism, to kind of, you know, recreate, you know, and produce knowledge about the Jewish past, whether these were journalists, scholars, culture brokers of different sorts. So there was a real, it sort of highlighted this incredible fault line in different perceptions, different narratives, you know, different understandings of what images of Jews might mean from Jews like me coming from abroad and local Polish people, including progressive ones, who found these images somehow a sign of their own identification, their commitment, or perhaps a kind of honorific towards Jews. And I should say that is even true. I think there's a kind of split or a fault line, or has become one, around the figurines that have holding coins, just because of that real crass and very dangerous stereotype associating with Jews with money, which of course goes back to medieval times, that those are somehow kind of beyond the pale. But even among people who buy those figurines, and I should say the figurines with the coins also have a strong sense of superstitious magic around them, a kind of sympathetic magic where the idea is that Jews were always good with money, so to say. Therefore, if I have one in my home, then money will, you know, I will be good in business as well. So, you know, even people who purchase these, you know, what one might say are really kind of overloaded with kind of anti-Semitic symbolism in them, generally see them as something positive about Jews, an attribute that they too would like to have. So it gets quite quite complicated.
If I may, I just want to interrupt.
Sure.
My wife's grandmother, my wife is born in Ukraine. My wife's grandmother told her if she has a dream with a jewel in it, she's going to get some money.
Right. And then, you know, there's much that I could say about the sort of relation between these sort of, you know, static, you know, kind of wooden forms, these sort of fetishes, and sometimes how I've felt myself treated as a Jewish person in Poland, having kinds of magical qualities, you know, kind of attributed to me. And I know this is the case from a Polish Jewish friend of mine in Warsaw, who has told a story about quite openly a business colleague of a non-Jew being asked by the non-Jew to come along on him with him, all expenses paid, on a business trip to another part of Poland, because the guy thought that if he had a Jew along, the business deal would go well. And so, you know, the idea of this kind of Jews being fetishes, whether they're in wooden form or actually in, you know, flesh and blood form, is also kind of disturbing. I think that it really shows like how deeply ingrained a sense of difference, superstition, and even kind of magical qualities were in a longstanding way and still are linked to Jews by Catholic Poles, even highly educated ones. You know, I think on the one hand, I want to say that it's important to me to maintain this idea that, you know, the radically different meaning that people associate with the same cultural form, means that the possibility that of something that looks horribly stereotypical, kitschy, or even anti-Semitic to one person can be another person's, however flawed, form of honoring Jews. And it can also even be a gateway to kind of deeper engagement, possibly. On the other hand, it's also a real indicator that celebrating Jewish cultural forms can go totally hand in hand with anti-Semitic attitudes without problem. So those things both, you know, exist side by side.
Well, you know, we don't have a lot more time, so I want to just skip to the question that you've already alluded to, and that's what has happened in the last decade with the rise of PIS, and how has that affected Jewish-Polish relations, heritage tourism, and all of those things? What are you seeing now?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is it's sort of so, you know, it's very disturbing events unfolding day by day. I have, you know, hundreds of tabs open on my trying to keep up with all of the op-eds that are being written. I guess, you know, staying on the trying to keep a bit of a focus on the question of heritage tourism and you know how these things focus and relate to and intertwine with some of the issues that I write about in my book. I mean, I should as a disclaimer start by saying that I haven't followed these issues in a fine-grained way since the end of my research in terms of in terms of the rise of the Peace Party and you know these issues of heritage projects. That said, I can give a few kind of broad strokes. So until quite recently, you know, one could say that Peace or the, you know, the Law and Justice, this very right-wing party, that their influence on Jewish heritage, tourism, heritage brokering, et cetera, was neutral or even positive in terms of Jewish heritage initiatives in Poland. So, you know, we have to remember that, for example, it was during former Polish president Lech Kaczynski's time when he was mayor of Warsaw that the city of Warsaw entered into this very important public-private partnership that funded the building of the multi-million dollar Pauline Museum. The thing is, the promotion of Jewish heritage initiatives is an area that both progressive and conservative forces can agree on, particularly if you don't scratch too deeply. So, you know, the cynical interpretation of the motives of Polish nationalists in these kinds of Jewish heritage projects is that investing in Jewish heritage plays really well on the international stage. It's an easy kind of PR to say, you know, look how much we appreciate our Jews. It helps counter longstanding Western concerns about Polish anti-Semitism. Now, of course, the content of these heritage initiatives is also important, not irrelevant. A narrative of, say, you know, we've had centuries of Polish-Jewish brotherhood is kind of a favored approach by right-wingers. And this narrative, of course, can, you know, definitely elides the very difficult events, you know, during those centuries, you know, anti-Semitic pogroms, you know, issues of the Holocaust, complicity in the killing of Jews, et cetera, post-war violence, anti-Semitic campaigns, et cetera. And this narrative, these narratives that are often promulgated in kinds of, you know, heritage initiatives that right-wingers may support, you know, may also play on anti-Semitic stereotypes in the way Jews are depicted. I mean, the figurines are a case in point, but, you know, what roles did Jews play in society? Even the constant distinction between, quote, Poles and Jews. So that in itself is really problematic language. It essentializes both groups, but generally portrays Jews as something that's really foreign to an essential Poland. But of course, you know, all of this has kind of, all of this sort of differentiation, all of this nuance has kind of changed in recent weeks, even since Peace enacted the so-called Holocaust Law, which criminalizes speech that implicates the Polish nation in Holocaust crimes. You know, now this has raised all sorts of questions, like really concrete, practical questions regarding Jewish heritage brokering, like, can foreign Jewish guides leading youth groups through Auschwitz be exposed to criminal proceedings, you know, if they say the wrong thing, if they say something that seems to portray the Polish nation negatively? Could Holocaust survivors themselves telling their own stories be prosecuted if they say something that displeases government officials? You know, it's really unclear whether tour guiding, for example, is the kind of public expression that falls under this law. You know, in also sinister ways, in really concrete ones, the new government is also beginning to make moves, and this is just really in the recent couple of weeks, to make moves towards changing the Pauline Museum's leadership. So swapping in board members that share their conservative views. And this has really disturbing echoes with this total travesty that was perpetrated against the World War II Museum in Gdansk in the past year, whose, you know, very cosmopolitan message about the war was essentially gutted along with the director in favor of a nationalist message. So that, you know, we need to see how that is going to play out. Also, a new museum, what's supposed to be titled the Warsaw Ghetto Museum, was also just announced by the Minister of Culture and Heritage, Piotr Gliński, who says, using just this this kind of discourse I was mentioning, that this museum will be a symbol of the brotherhood of Poles and Jews. So clearly, you know, in the same neighborhood, another large museum, clearly an attempt to sort of speak back at the Pauline Museum's narrative, despite the fact that, you know, I mean, many people have criticized the Pauline Museum as being, I mean, if not balanced, it's been criticized as being like too pro-Polish. So, you know, there are lots of things unfolding right now, which really, you know, point to a darker turn, where it's going to be harder and harder to maintain these sort of spaces for independent critical culture on any topic, but especially on the Jewish issue, because the peace government, you know, really wants to control, they want to reverse what they call this last couple of decades of so-called pedagogy of shame, which of course I think of as being, you know, really important, appropriate, you know, national introspection and reckoning with history. They want to replace that so-called shameful pedagogy with a kind of pedagogy of pride, celebration, which, you know, makes it much easier to look at any expression of Jewish heritage, kind of promulgation or celebration, with a cynical eye rather than looking at its possibility. I would maybe, just that said, I would maybe leave with the idea that at the same time, you could say that it makes the, you know, the independent producers of Jewish heritage initiatives all the more important, because those spaces for independent progressive culture are radically shrinking in Poland today. So despite the fact that, you know, I'm maybe, like, you know, looking very much through a really narrow and even narrowing lens, I feel like that makes my championing of the champions of Jewish culture, you know, with a critical eye in Poland, all the more important today.
Well, thank you. As I said, the book is fascinating. I highly recommend it. Could you just briefly tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, what am I working on now? Okay, well, I'm currently working on a curatorial project related through a few steps to this issue of the figurines, the Jewish figurines, which I, you know, tangentially wrote about in the book. So, I mean, those led me to a broader interest in so-called Polish folk art, mostly in the form of wood carving, but a kind of related genre that depicts in wooden form the Nazi occupation of Poland. The project is called Awkward Objects of Genocide, and there will be an exhibition in the Krakow Ethnographic Museum opening in November of this year and running through March 2019. This is a team project I'm working on with three Polish colleagues, so Roma Sendyka from the Jagiellonian University, Magdalena Zich from the Ethnographic Museum, and an independent photographer, Wojciech Wilczek, who's done fabulous work photographing synagogues across Poland and Polish nationalist graffiti. This genre of folk art is really a kind of uncanny sort of carving, mostly dating to the 1960s and 70s. And it's quite tantalizing to us because it seems to offer potentially a new kind of source base to get a glimpse of bystander Holocaust memory. So, you know, what did Polish villagers, Polish peasants, what did they see? What did they feel? What did they remember? What did they later document and communicate about the expulsion and the killing of their Jewish neighbors? You know, Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands and Father Dubois' Holocaust by Bullets. So these kind of works have really drawn attention to these much more intimate sites of killing that took place outside of camps during the Holocaust with the participation of local East European populations. And these carved sculptures that we're looking at they've really been sort of lost in the archives in Polish ethnographic and folk museums and collections. And we use the title Awkward Objects because the form disrupts so many accepted narratives, like that folk art is always timeless, happy, and superficial. It disrupts certain interesting Holocaust representation taboos because many of these artworks that we're working with sort of go places that the Western taboo, at least high art taboo, that stopped short of depicting things like the inside of gas chambers or crematoria. This kind of folk art actually goes there. And the question also of whether we can call this witness art if it was made for commercial markets and if it was made at the urging of a communist state. And it also raises questions of how the Holocaust was sort of Polonized. Like, so Jews frequently get swapped out in favor of characters that support Polish martyrology. And maybe one last thing, this is the part that I think fascinates me most about this project, is one of the most interesting questions it raises is whose memory is being represented in these artworks? Because it turns out that the most prominent collectors of this kind of art, who also played roles in commissioning specific themes, were German collectors. Now, the idea that Polish peasant folk art, which, you know, has been certainly during the communist period, was represented as like the soul of the Polish nation. You know, it's what the folk themselves made. And particularly these scenes representing World War II suffering, the idea that these would actually be co-produced by Germans is a pretty striking revelation to digest. You know, basically, we want to draw attention with this project to, on the one hand, a forgotten art form that raises really thorny questions about whether and how Polish bystanders viewed and remember the Holocaust, at least in this form, you know, given all these various kinds of pressures on artistic expression, at that time, given all of the different players in the industry. So I hope if listeners hear this and are interested and can make it to Poland sometime next fall or winter, they'll see the exhibition.
I would love to make it there. Well, Erica, it has been a pleasure talking about your book, Jewish for All and Revisited Heritage Tourism in Unquiet Places, which is published by Indiana University Press. And until next time, I wish our listeners the best. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Hugo. Bye.